To better your best and your world, you need to dig deep and grow. Join us as top experts, leaders, and creators uncover powerful insights to help you grow in life and in work. And now, your host, Michael McAvoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Dig Deep Grow, the show dedicated to helping you better your best and your world. Today, we're going to be talking about the future, and what better person to talk to than Tom Kolopoulos, the author of 9 books, all having a kind of a future trend kind of impact, especially for business. Tom's latest book is called The Gen Z Effect, The 6 Forces Shaping the Future of Business. So, Tom, I'd like to welcome you to the program.
Michael, thank you very much. My pleasure to be here with you.
Okay. So, you talk about 6 forces in this book. Before we dive into that, I'd like to just ask you if you could give a quick overview of, you know, what you do, what your role has been, the focus of your work.
Well, it's a small question. It's got a long answer, but I'll try to keep it very brief. I really try to focus on identifying the significant trends that businesses need to pay attention to as they move into the future. And that, in some cases, is technology. In a lot of cases, it's behavioral. And in some cases, it's economic as well. So my role is to be that lead scout who tries as best I can from observation, from research that we do at Delphi Group, and from a whole lot of work in the trenches to identify what the significant trends really are. And, of course, there's lots of noise in the marketplace. There always has been. There's more so as we move forward. And trying to separate what really is significant from the noise is a big challenge. But that's where I take the most joy and pleasure out of my work, is in being able to figure that out.
Okay. And just say briefly, the Delphi Group, what is the main work that you do there?
For 25 years, we're Boston-based. We're sort of a hybrid between a think tank and an analyst firm. We have done a lot of original research. We do a lot of events, and we have clients, mostly larger organizations, but increasingly mid-size and startups as well. We're having a pretty big impact on the economy. And they work with us to help them identify how to best invest, not just in technology, but also in their people. We've built innovation practices for some large companies, and we also work with a lot of startups to help them put in the right culture from the outset to scale their organizations.
Okay, and it always helps to have the latest, your finger on the trend to save a lot of time and money with those new firms. So
it does, and that's what they're looking for. You know, they're looking for what's real. How do I separate the blue smoke and mirrors from what I really need to put my time and money into?
Okay, so I'm going to ask you now to dive in on your new book called The Gen Z Effect. You know, it seems like over the last decade or 15 years that every couple of years there's a new kind of letter given to a generation. So now we're up to Gen Z, and there seems to be, you know, at least the people I've spoke to, especially in business, that, you know, they're scratching their heads trying to figure out, hey, how do I, you know, bring the different generations within my business together? It seems like there's a disconnect. So before we get into the specifics of the book, I'll just ask you to kind of put the whole perspective on these different generations and what's been happening in business around, you know, this whole generational thing.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right, Michael. If we look backwards in time, so much of the last 50 to 60 years has been spent really focusing very heavily on this notion of generations, multiple generations, generation gaps. And what we don't realize is that while there's always going to be some degree of difference between age cohorts, because we have different experience sets, the world changes, obviously, it doesn't stay the same. We've obsessed about generations to the degree that we've really driven wedges into our organizations. And the premise of the book is that going forward, as we look into the future, we have to think in a post-generational fashion. So like you said, we can't keep on assigning letters and numbers and whatever else every 2-3 years to the next generation. That simply makes no sense. And we're at a point in time right now where we can really understand the behaviors of the individual. So when my son, who's 15 years old, gets online and games, he's gaming with folks who are, in some cases, in their 30s, 50s, 60s, perhaps even 80s and 90s.
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't really care what age they are. What he cares about is the results. Do they work well on his team? Can he game with them? Are they good gamers?
Mm-hmm.
I think that same philosophy is what we have to bring to business. How do we set aside a lot of these generational divisions and focus on how we collaborate in a post-generational world where we will have five, six, maybe seven generations all working at the same time under one roof?
Right. That was one of the big things that I took away from your book, that, you know, we simply can't continue to think in silos as far as generations are concerned, because things are happening so rapidly that, you know, everything has to come together and all people will have to be on board with this generation or be left behind. And I'm speaking of businesses mostly here, but that seemed to come through pretty loud and clear. I wanted to ask you to speak to that topic about why is it that now is the time where the generations are, you know, the borders between these generations are going to dissolve?
So there's a very specific answer to that, and this really is one of the cornerstones of the book. And it's that technology has finally gotten to the point where it's so easy to use, it is so inexpensive, and so pervasive in every aspect of our lives that we're all using the same platforms, and we don't need the kind of education that we once needed, the user's manuals that we once needed. My son jokes, you know, Dad, if it comes with a user's manual, it's broken. I don't want to read a manual. I just want to be able to use it. And that same attitude applies to the 80-year-old grandmother who's using Skype on an iPad to communicate with her 2-year-old toddler grandson. So technology is now a universal platform that we can all use and we can all connect and collaborate through. And that's pretty significant. You know, in our lifetime, I'm certain that we will see virtually every last human being on the planet connected to the Internet. That will happen. Today, there's only about 2 billion out of the 7 billion that really are connected in any meaningful way.
Mm-hmm.
When that world is here, when all 10 billion, whatever the number is, are connected, that will create a phenomenon that humanity has never experienced before. And in that world, it doesn't matter how old you are. What matters is, are you the right person for me to work with, to collaborate with, to play with, to engage and to interact with? And age becomes a secondary topic at best. It's always going to be there. We'll always wonder about age. It's very human to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But it won't play the leading role that I think it has for us, especially in businesses and in organizations.
Yeah, it seems as if you put forth a pretty positive view of the future because of, you know, this ubiquity of the technology and the fact that there's just so much new things happening because of technology. But, you know, there's a lot of people who are saying, well, you know, the people who aren't able to keep up with the technology curve are going to be left behind. Robotics are going to put people out of work. So there's going to be less people with less jobs and more people. What's your response to that?
I think that this is a constant human condition. We've always had this fear. The Luddites had this fear at the turn of the industrial age. This is nothing new for humanity. We've always been concerned that the skills and the capabilities we have will somehow be displaced by whatever technology is about to come next. And I think this was probably as true for medieval days and armor as it is for the kinds of technologies we use today in our own battlefields, individually, personally, organizationally. So the fear is not new. We've always been concerned that we'll be put out of business, if you will. And AI now is now putting a whole new twist on that, as is robotics, right? We think that we're threatened by AI because somehow it will negate the need for humanity. I don't believe that's ever been the case. I think that history has proven that to be the point, and I don't think that ever will be the case.
Mm-hmm.
One of my mentors, Peter Drucker, once said that what we typically overestimate is the degree to which technology can replace our ability to educate ourselves. And that really is what it comes down to, Michael, is can we re-educate and retool ourselves, those of us that will remain in the workforce, who want to remain engaged, to live in this new future with these new technologies? I think the answer is yes. We're seeing it. And that's what's encouraging to me. When I see the grandmother and the grandfather using the iPad and talking to their grandkids, when I see folks in disadvantaged situations across the world using technology to increase their standard of living and their prosperity and their access to simple things like sanitation and clean water, that to me is the promise of Gen Z, and that is always going to outweigh the short-term pain that we and frustration that we'll have to go with as we retool and re-educate. But that's nothing new. That's always been the trajectory of humanity. I think it will continue to be that way.
Okay. Now, the major tech companies, you know, the Facebooks, the Googles of the world, it would be fair to say that, by and large, the workforce does skew kind of young, you know, usually in the 20s and 30s. Is that right?
Yes. You're absolutely right. And that is one of the disconnects in today's marketplace, is that we think that if you're not young, your options are very, very limited, which is in part why we wrote the book, to say, look, this is it's not a birthright. It is a choice. And what counts is how you behave, not just when you were born. But look, we are at that very precarious point right now. Think of a plane taking off. We're at the end of the runway. And the rules that apply when you're in the air don't apply when you're on the ground. You use different controls and different mechanisms to navigate that plane on the ground than you do when you're in the air. We are now taking off, and that means that we will have to adopt some radically different behaviors. So I'm not saying it's going to be completely comfortable. I'm not saying the transition will be without some degree of frustration and some casualties. Mm-hmm. But again, it is a choice that we make, and it's a choice that in some cases will require a little bit of rolling up the sleeves and educating ourselves. But education is everywhere today. Massive online classrooms that we talk about in the book are available to anyone at any age. It used to be that you'd only go to get your MBA if you were under a certain age. Well, I'll tell you, I teach graduate classes at Boston University and a number of other schools here locally. I've got students who are in their 60s and 70s who are coming back with an MBA. So it's all changing. And what we try to get across in the book is that change is your choice. You can do this if you decide to. But not everyone will. Let's face it, not everyone will.
Right. Get this podcast delivered to you automatically. You can subscribe via iTunes, Stitcher, and more. You'll find the links here or on our website, digdeepgrow.com. Well, you just touched on one of those six forces, so I think we'll go through the whole education piece first. I think that that's probably the most disruptive of the forces that you mentioned. So what's your kind of future view of how, say, my daughter, 12 years old, what education post-secondary is she going to be exposed to?
I think that's I agree with you, it is one of the most disruptive forces, this whole notion of what we call adopting the world as a classroom. So your daughter, my son at 15, will have an incredible spectrum of options. And I'll give you just a quick anecdote here that speaks to their mindset, how they're looking at this. My son at 14 began going online and taking some of the MIT courses because he just felt like it. And he spends a fair amount of time online, so he thought he'd do something interesting and productive, and I applauded him for it. And then one day he came to me, Michael, and he said, you know, gee, Dad, I'm taking these courses. If I take all of these courses by the time I graduate high school, do I really have to go to college, and won't MIT just give me a degree? I said, Adam, I wish that was the case, but I'm afraid it doesn't quite work that way. But I've got a good friend of mine who was a trustee at MIT, and I asked him the same question. I said, what do you do when these kids show up on your doorstep and they've taken all of your classes? What value do you have left to confer other than the degree itself? Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, it is a good question, because whether it's Stanford or whether it's MIT or Harvard, these curriculums are online, and it will change the options that these kids have. But here's the most interesting piece of it. For your daughter, for my son, a traditional post-secondary university level education is probably still in the cards to a large degree. Mm-hmm. But what about that child on the subcontinent of India or in Africa or in some other part of the world where they don't have access to that kind of education? The classroom, at least. Mm-hmm. Do they really need the degree? And the answer is, you know, for them, having the education itself without the degree is incredibly meaningful, and it allows them to plug into a global economy. So the way I look at this is not just how does it change post-secondary education in the developed world, where we may follow the same trajectory for some period of time going forward, but how does it educate the rest of the world? And what does that create in terms of a global knowledge-based workforce? I think the promise there is astounding. And that's probably what we talk about in the book, is how does that change the way our businesses here in the USA operate? Because now they have access to a global talent pool, the likes of which we've never seen before. Very different world, much more competitive, certainly, much more egalitarian, but also much more able to solve some of the big problems that face us.
Right. I think that the online education movement is going to flatten the workforce yet again. With high tech workers, and the wages they earn are going to vary across the world. But do you think that in 10 years' time, that the degree, a college degree, will carry the same financial benefit? You know, there's studies that say that, you know, you get X dollars of income per year because you attended college versus high school. Do you think that's still going to be the case?
In 10 years' time, I think that still will be the case, but I think we'll see dramatic changes. My sense is that if the cost of education continues to increase as it has, that the net benefit might very well start to approach zero. There's an aspect of this that I just touched on that I think is very important to keep in mind, however. There may not be as much of a delta for someone in the developed world. They do it because it helps them to network and to plug into the right circle of friends and acquaintances and colleagues. But for someone who's never had access to that sort of education, just being able to access the content alone provides them with an enormous increase in the potential income and value that they can create, and income that they can receive. So I think we have to look at this as a global question, not just isolated to the developed world and to the U.S., where certainly I think some of that is changing. But in the rest of the world, just having access to that content is providing an enormous increase in potential income and prosperity.
Yeah, and I think that having the college out of the way, that the reality beyond college will be that in order to continue creating value, people are going to be having to continue their education online, basically for their entire lives. So that's one aspect. There's one other force that of the six that in particular I had a little trouble grasping. I wanted you to go into what this whole notion of slingshotting is.
Yeah. So slingshotting was actually one of the last forces that we came up with. And it's interesting that you say you had some difficulty getting your head around it, because we did as well when we first started thinking about it. But it makes a lot of sense when you simplify it. Slingshotting is nothing more than what I described earlier. It's the ability to skip entire generations, multiple generations of technology, not of people, of technology, and move directly into the future. So the best way I can describe this is, as I was growing up, and I'm sure as you were growing up, Michael, we used many generations of very difficult technologies. We had to be our own tech support. We had to put up with a lot of frustration, some catastrophic incidents when we'd lose that hard drive. All of that is changing going forward. Suddenly, someone can go directly to a touch-based mobile device without ever having touched a laptop or a desktop or any other kind of computer. So it's a build this slingshot directly into the future without the user's manual, as I said, without necessarily having to be trained on the technology, just by using it in an intuitive way, is really altering the degree to which the community that is on this common technology platform is growing. And the rate at which it's growing now is exceptional because it is so simple and so intuitive to use the technology. So that's slingshotting. It's jumping ahead of many generations of very awkward, in some cases difficult to use technologies, and leaping directly into the future. I think we always underestimate the degree to which any sort of technology, whether it be the printing press or whether it be the mobile phone, will be able to impact our behavior and the way that we collaborate with each other. You know, when the Motorola brick was first introduced in the 1980s, the projections for the number of cell phones by the year 2000 hovered around anywhere between 10 million and 100 million, which seems paltry because today we do have 7 billion cell numbers enabled globally, which is as many as we have human beings. How can you be that far off? How can you be, it's not a rounding error, from 100 million to 7 billion? And the reason is that we always underestimate the degree to which the slingshotting will occur. So we think it's one of the most powerful forces to bring people online and to create this common platform for Gen Z to communicate on and to collaborate on.
Okay. You mentioned twice already now the idea of the ease of use, not having an owner's manual for a lot of this technology. What is the lesson currently for companies who may not have that ease of use? You know, I can think of some enterprise type software that still is pretty dense. So what's your comment there? Does this have ramifications for these companies?
I can sum it up in two letters, UX. It is all about what's popularly been termed the user experience. If companies are not obsessively focusing on the notion of the user experience and how to make that not just painless and intuitive, but how to make it as valuable and as engaging as possible, then they're not doing the right things. Gamifying your application, we talk about gamification in the book, so that people want to use it, they want to engage in it, they take pleasure and joy out of being in that application. That's the kind of future that companies need to be looking at when they design and build their interfaces. And you're right, a lot of enterprise software, if you look at what's available today, not just what's been available over the last 20 to 30 years, but what's in use today, falls far short of the kind of expectation that Gen Z has for a user interface. So those companies, I think, are quickly going to start feeling the pressure to move forward. And if they don't respond, then frankly, I don't think they're going to survive because the user experience will be one of the most innovative areas and one of the most competitive areas where people will fight for customer loyalty.
Right. Now, one of the other forces you mentioned is breaking generations. And you use a demographic, I believe you had a chart in there, that shows that the difference in age groups is going to basically unify. So I wanted you to speak to that a little bit and what that means.
Yeah, people are amazed by what they're describing. So to give it a little bit of illustration here, as we talk about it, imagine the shape of a pyramid for the entirety of history. Global population has been distributed as a pyramid shape, which means that at the bottom of the pyramid, you have this base at the bottom of the pyramid of lots of young people. And as you move towards the top, obviously the pyramid tapers in, and we all exit the pyramid at some point, but depending on what part of the world you're looking at and what time frame, clearly infant mortality, teenage mortality, young adult mortality will differ. The shape of the pyramid will differ as a result. But what we're seeing is this homogenization because of better access to health care, because of the fact that we are topping out in terms of the maximum size of the population that the globe can support. Most people put that at about 10 billion. We're approaching that very, very quickly. So what you have between 2020 and 2100, you will have not a pyramid anymore, but what we call a skyscraper, where every age band, every five-year age band, from 0 through 4 years old up through 60 through 64 years old, will be virtually identical in terms of the number of people globally in that age band. We've never seen anything like that before. Now, of course, we'll be living longer, so that will only continue. So I say 60 to 64, but of course people will be living to 80, 90, 100 years old. And the pyramid will taper off because we're not immortal. We will all depart the pyramid at some point. But increasingly, that homogenization of the number of people in each age band means, number one, that we'll have more people in the workforce any one time. Folks are not retiring as quickly. The Gen Z natives that we surveyed tell us that they likely will never retire. About 33% of us overall say we will not retire, and that number is increasing because more options are available to stay in the workforce. So as we move from that pyramid to that skyscraper, we now have this intense collaboration across age groups in all venues, be they political, be they social, be they organizational. And we really have to ask the question, can we use the same kinds of attitudes that we used in the past to separate generations and the excuses we used why we couldn't work across generations in that sort of a global population distribution. And the answer is no, of course we can. We've got to learn how to work together. And that's the premise of the book, is how do we enter this post-generational world where some fundamental aspects of how we are built globally as a society, as a population, are going to alter the way that we work, live, and play. And it's immutable. This is happening. We're not going to do anything to stop this or stem this. It's not like global warming, where we could potentially do things to alter the trajectory of it. This is the trajectory of global population, and this is the way it's going to look over the course of the next 100 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm speaking with Tom Kalopoulos about his new book, The Gen Z Effect, and we've been talking about the different driving forces that are shaping the future of business. You touched on one of them in your answer there, and that is the idea of hyperconnecting, where you're just going to have this interaction among generations and computers and machines, et cetera. Speak to that a little bit.
Yeah. So I touched on, but what I've really left out up until now is this notion of not just connecting people, but connecting things. So what's popularly called the Internet of Things, the IoT, is the ability to create some form of connectivity and intelligence in virtually every object that we touch and we interact with. There's a short story in the book that we tell about a good friend whose daughter loves to play on the iPad. And the daughter, Julia, is only about 2 years old, but she loves her iPad, and she loves to play the game Concentration, where you flip over cards to match what's behind the card, and plays it obsessively on the iPad. She's very, very good at it, very bright child. So one day, her mother, Lynn, decided, why not lay out a bunch of real cards on the floor and let Julia experience in the real world the game of Concentration? So she went to the drugstore, she bought a Concentration deck, brought it home, laid out the cards. Julia got very excited when she saw the pattern of the cards. She knew what this meant. She knew the game, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And then her mom said, go ahead, Julia, flip over a card. And, of course, what did Julia do? She got down on the floor, and she tapped the card. and nothing happened, of course.
Yeah.
And she tapped it again, and nothing happened. And in a moment of revelation, her mother realized, oh, my goodness, she doesn't realize that the card won't flip itself, because that's what they do on the iPad.
Wow.
And Julia got very frustrated. Then she messed the cards up, and you could tell that she was visibly anxious because of this. Her expectation was, the world should respond to me. Objects should be intelligent.
Mm.
So we're seeing this blurring of the digital world and the real world, and the Internet of Things is going to connect virtually everything from our toothbrushes to our automobiles, which already have, by the way, several hundred sensors that are communicating not just with each other, but in many cases with the cloud.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of your behaviors are being tracked by your insurance company or by OnStar or by other providers. The notion of having intelligent cars that can understand your behavior and your patterns is something which is very big in the automotive industry. But I think everything from home appliances to the clothes that we wear to things that we would never associate with computing today will be part of this massive network. And the key here is not the so what, is not just that these will be individual computing devices, but that they will talk to each other. And that creates a level of intelligence, awareness, understanding of behavior that, again, we've never experienced as a species. And some of it will be very invasive. Some of it will be creepy. We won't like some of it. We'll be giving up information and privacy that we don't want to give up. And I think we have to be very vigilant as a society to negotiate the terms of this new Internet of Things in the right way. But that said, again, this is going to happen because the value here, I think, is far too great to stop the trajectory of it. And by the way, the numbers here are mind-boggling. So when we project it out, every decade since 1960, the number of computing devices has increased by one order of magnitude. So today we have about 10 billion total computing devices on the face of the planet. If you project that out until 2100, you actually end up with more computing devices than you have grains of sand on all the Earth's beaches. In fact, 100 times as many computing devices as there are grains of sand on all the Earth's beaches. That's a number that's almost impossible to wrap our head around. But we're talking about a computing device being a pill that you take in the morning.
Mm.
These devices will be incredibly small, will be embedded into so much of our world that we will no longer notice them. And that will create not just a volume of information, but a volume of connections and understanding that I think will truly be mind-boggling in comparison to what we're experiencing today.
If what you're projecting actually becomes a reality, then for all those young people entering the college and you're looking for something, computer science probably is going to work out pretty well for you. Would you agree with that?
I agree. There's enormous opportunity here. We can't even begin to describe the extent of it. So I do think that today the intersection of understanding behavior and technology is a wonderful place. My daughter, in fact, is studying at Rochester, and she has a fascination with the intersection of psychology and sustainability. Mm. So these kids are seeing it. They get that there's something going on that will make this a very different world, and they're beginning to invest their time and their effort in understanding what those differences will be. And by the way, today we see them doing that, and we sometimes discount it. So we talk about the fact that they're on social networks as a way that they are losing the humanity of socialization. And while there might be a smidgen of truth to that, there's also a lot of value that we just don't see because we haven't lived that future yet.
Right. It's still in progress.
Absolutely.
All right. So one other topic I'd like to look at, and then we'll have to wrap up. But the force that I'm talking about is life hacking. If you could say a few words about that, then we'll wrap it up.
Just a little bit on that, because life hacking is one of the forces that fascinates me. We see it all the time. This new generation by birth, Gen Z by birth, anyone born after the turn of the millennium, doesn't take no for an answer. They want to hack the system, to change it, to conform to their view of what's right, to their view of purpose and mission in the world. And that, to me, is extremely encouraging. They will remove obstacles in their way to do what they think is right. And that's a power that this generation has that, again, I think we can all start to embrace, that will take entrenched interests that have often stood in the way of a more egalitarian society, remove them and put in place the kinds of values that I think we all ultimately aspire to. So life hacking isn't just, you know, how do you crack an egg better, or how do you, you know, do simple things to change, you know, the way you operate around your house. It's really how do you change the way that you live. And we see this in everything from changes in genomics to the way that education is changing. Hacking the system to fundamentally alter the obstacles that have stood in the way, the entrenched interests that have stood in the way of doing the right thing.
Right. So, and in one word, that would be disruptive technology.
Extraordinarily. Probably the most disruptive force. Yeah, absolutely, Michael. Probably the most disruptive force, because entrenched interests don't like to be dislodged.
Exactly.
That is not the nature of any entrenched interest.
Okay, so as we close, is there anything that you want to share that I didn't address or ask you about?
You know, we wrote the book because we ourselves were experiencing this with our kids, and what I would ask people to do is to use the Gen Z mindset to look at these behaviors in a new, more positive way. The future always astounds us and inspires us and amazes us. When we look back, we wonder why we didn't get it. I think a lot of times the reason we don't get it is because we focus on the technology and not the value of these new behaviors. Gen Z is about new behaviors, and we can adopt them, we can choose to make them part of our lives, but we first have to observe them and do so with an open mind.
Great. Well, Tom Kalopoulos, thank you for joining me today. Again, the book is The Gen Z Effect, The Six Forces Shaping the Future of Business. That book is out, so you can find that at all the major outlets for books. Tom, thanks again for joining me today.
Michael, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.